Let's go. Here was Wookie talking about bootstrapping ARM 64.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I'm sorry it's so early. Is that better? Hello, hello, hello. Okay. How many of you have already seen me give a talk about ARM 64 at FOSDEM or ELC last year? Oh, less than half. Okay, well, you should just have stayed in bed for an extra half hour, because I'm afraid this talk hasn't changed enormously since then. The first half, at least, is the same. Most of you already know who I am. I've been doing this for quite a long time now. For the last 3 years, I've been working for, ARM pay me, Linaro tell me what to do, kind of. I don't necessarily take that much notice. Mostly, that's been doing multi-arch, bootstrapping, cross-building, ARM 64. As you can see, I shall tell you about three bootstraps, because it turns out that's how many it takes. We'll just start off with a little bit of history and context for the ARM 64 architecture, because some of you may not know this. We all think of them as mobile phone machines, but actually, they've been around for a long time as real computers. Back when I first started, Acorn RISC PC, it's a proper desktop machine. That was in 1994, which is, of course, bloody ages ago. And we've had servers since the Rebel Netwinder in 2000, who were the people that did a lot of the original work on making ARM Linux work at all, on the strong ARM, which was the first fast ARM CPU. It's pretty embarrassingly slow by modern standards. And, of course, these days, we've got fancy rack-mounted servers, like real computers. There's one over there from the nice Boston people. And little things like this, which make a perfectly good desktop computer. It's got two USB sockets, Ethernet and HDMI in the back. That's a whole computer. That's all you needed. That's true. I do, don't I? Yeah, because there'll be a lot of this. Of course, now we have laptops, which are also real computers on which people want to run. Oh, wow. Toys. Okay. So, the Scion netbook invented the term netbook and was a long time ahead of its time, and some of the people in this room had something to do with making ARM Linux work on that. It never actually got sold to anybody, but it was a cool toy. And these days you can buy real computers. They come with Chrome OS, but we can fix that. So, the Debian ARM ports. So the first one was the old ABI ARM, which unfortunately used up the good name. Back in 2000, which we have recently given up with. There was the ill-fated ARM EB port, which we tried not to talk about, which was the slug machines, NSLU2s, which, because they had a proprietary Ethernet driver, the only way to make it work was to rebuild the entire rest of the operating system big-endian so that you could install the Ethernet driver. And astonishingly, somebody could be bothered doing that. Kudos to Leonard Buitenhek. But they soon really reversed engineered the driver, and the need for that went away, so we've been ignoring big endian hard ever since. We've since had the ARM EL and later ARM HF ports for V4T and V7 instruction set ARMs, and of course now ARM 64. Everyone gets very excited. Proper computers, 64-bit servers. And of course, oddly, the first one is a mobile phone from those lovely Apple people. We hope to have this in Jesse. Well, I do. Unfortunately, as there are some reasons why that might be difficult. We'll get to that later. So just for all of you who are confused about the nomenclature, ARM wants us to call the architecture ARCH64, but it's a silly name, so we're calling it ARM64 because that's a sensible name. ARMv8 is technically the CPU architecture, which includes the ARCH64 instruction set mode, blah, blah, blah. As far as most people are concerned, all these three refer to the same thing, and you really don't need to worry about it too much. I'm going to talk a bit about cross-building. And I always have to put this slide up before I talk about cross-building, because the nomenclature is incredibly confusing. So build means the machine you're building on, host means the architecture you're building for, and target is the sort of code that things like compilers generate code for. So host is not the machine you are building on. If you're writing software, don't write that in all your variable names, PyBit people. It's very confusing. It's all GNU's fault, but they did set these names 20 years ago, and we probably ought not to keep changing them. So, bootstrapping. We think of bootstrapping as this special thing which we have to do occasionally for a new architecture, but actually, if you tot it up, we've done 22 bootstraps in 20 years. So actually, we do this at least once a year. So it's not that unusual, and it would be nice if it was less epic. So that's something I've talked about before. So just this year, the MIP64EL people did their port, and of course the ARM64 port's been going on. So Debian really ought to be better at bootstrapping itself. Generally, we have to use something else that was easier, where they already did it, and then take that forward. And so build dependency loops. Now, I think most of you have seen my explodey diagram thing. I'll have a quick go at making this work for those that haven't. Which requires finding the right window, sorry. No, I've got loads of time. I need to choose pick terminals that are actually on this computer and not some other computer. That would help. Sorry. Oh, well, anyway, that's why it's difficult. So that's a dependency graph of Debian. So people think you start at the beginning and build things in order. That would be much easier if there wasn't an order. But in fact, it's a big circle. It's all squiggly. There is nowhere to start, which is a problem. So because we build everything natively by default, we configure everything generally, turn everything on if it will work. And because we distribute binaries, it's difficult to bootstrap. It's much easier if you start from source and build things with lots of configure flags, because configure is quite flexible generally. It'll do the right thing, and if you haven't got stuff, it won't build it yet. The Debian packaging isn't, and tries very hard to make sure that what you get is what you said you were going to get. So if something's missing, it just says no. That's annoying when you haven't got that yet. So the normal process has been, as I say, to boot some other distro. So the first 8 or 10 Debian ports were almost all booted bootstrapped using Red Hat, which I was slightly surprised at, actually. Even obscure ports. And more recently, people have tended to use Open Embedded, because it's really quite easy to bring up, relatively speaking, a new architecture on OE. And when once you've got something you can boot, then you can start hacking and removing all the docs and building stuff. But it's always been painful. Now, we get an extra problem these days, especially with a new port like ARM64, that there is no hardware. So you can't build something else, stick it on your box, and start hacking. There isn't a box yet. If you're really lucky, you might have a model, which is not quite infinitely slow, but it's pretty close. That's like a 10 megahertz box or something, 20 megahertz, I don't know. They really are shocking. And anyway, I think Debian ought to be able to boot itself. So I've been doing a lot of work on that. I'm not going to go into too much of the detail of that in this talk, partly because many of you have heard it before, and also because I want to go on to the fun stuff later. But this is just a slide about that. So the thing you need to be able to do fundamentally is specify that for this particular build, stop putting it on my screen, I don't want libsql for whatever the hell this package was, because I haven't got SQL yet, and I can't build it until after I've built what I'm building now. We came up with this syntax of having a build depends and a build depends stage one, which had fewer things in it, which was the noddy version about 3 years ago. And we implemented that and used it a bit. But it's pretty ugly, actually. Inside dpackage, you end up with just repeating thousands of build depends and build depends indep and all the other sorts of depends, which could technically also have a stage one. Not surprisingly, the dpackage developers went, "Ew, no, don't do that, that's horrible," and suggested that instead we just use a kind of angle bracket syntax to say, this dependency is not used in stage one, which seemed quite sensible. So we started using that and wrote some patches. But then we actually talked to Debian Devel, and they went, no, that's the last spare character for creating crazy shit in dependencies. If you use that up, we'll never be able to do anything else. So please use square brackets like we do for architectures. And we went, okay, and changed it all again, and wrote a specification and everything. And then the depackage maintainers went, yeah, you know what, actually, I think we prefer the one with the angle brackets. I don't fucking care, just put one in. So anyway, we're still waiting for our delightful depackage maintainer to pick one, put it in, but we have patches for all of those. And that's holding things up, actually. It's getting a bit annoying, but it's promised to be in the next release of depackage, 1.17.2, which I believe is due 2 weeks ago. So hopefully we'll finally be over that hump any second now. And then basically the patches you put in packages are generally fairly simple, of the form, if you set deb build profile to stage one, then deb help is great with this dash n. Don't do this package. It just doesn't do anything to do with that package. So usually you can have quite a neat patch, so it doesn't get in your package maintainer's way, and we can maintain this stuff and test it all the time and so on. That's the plan. Now, how many people here don't understand multi-arch? Okay. So, to be honest, I was hoping to avoid explaining multi-arch at this hour of the day, because I thought, I've told you all before, we'll have a really quick version. Kind of. More than most people. There was a moment at DebConf when we had all 8 people in the world that understood multi-arch in one little room around a table. If you'd bombed it, that would have been that. Fundamentally, it's the ability to install multiple architectures side by side, and we do that by changing the paths of things in the packages. So there becomes a canonical place for each thing to go. So this library used to just be installed to this place, but only once for one of each architectures, and you had to pick one. Now we architecture qualify it, so you put it in this path, so you can have all three of these installed at once. And so long as the loaders know that they should now look for libraries in here instead of in here, that basically works. Blah, blah, blah. That means that everything has a place. So when you're cross-building, you don't look in a different place to find things like you always used to under all the other schemes. It's kind of neat. And you can install... In general, you only want to install sensible architectures at the same time, like i386 and AMD64. But you can, in fact, install completely random things, like ARM64 and i386 together, and MIPS32. And at least it will all go on the file system. Now, whether that's useful or not depends on exactly what you're trying to do with that file system. It's very easy to set up. You just add an architecture, and then you can install things from a different architecture. So one of the use cases is random proprietary binaries for stuff that only comes in 32-bit form and you've got a 64-bit machine. And then this dependency stuff will ensure that all the libraries that package needs will also get installed. I'm not going to go through this morning because... it makes my head hurt. One of the things that allows us to do, as well as installing foreign architecture binaries, is make cross-building easier. So in order to cross-build something for ARM64 on an x86 machine, I have to have the libraries it needs for the host architecture installed. That's the ARM64 architecture. So multi-arch means it's easy to install them from the same packages that Debian already makes for the architecture. They'll just go in the right place, and the dependencies all work just as they did in your normal system. So I just have to say, dear apt, please install the dependencies for the cross-dependencies for this architecture. And it goes, okay, I'm running on this, I'm going to target that, so I need to install these things. And basically, it'll get all the library-type stuff for the host architecture and all the tools for the build architecture. It's as simple to use as... what's this trying to illustrate? So this is the manual version of the same thing. This is saying you can just apt-get the tools you need and the libraries for the target architecture. But in fact... If everything's working right, you can do apt-get-a-arm64 build dep package, and it'll work all that out for you. It's fair to say that at this moment in time, that works better in Ubuntu than it does in Debian, but it does work for an increasing subset of things. So, a while back, decided they needed to bootstrap ARM64, mostly so they had something to give to people doing the early bring-up work. So we decided to use Ubuntu Maverick and a tool called Xdeb. So this was before all the multi-arch stuff was done. This was a kind of a thing we were heading towards, but it didn't work even slightly at that point. So Xdeb is a tool which Colin Watson wrote, which was originally written to create Chromols, in fact, but they stopped using that. And it's a great big evil Python thing that works out all the dependencies and guesses from the names. If it's called dash dev, it's probably a library, except for a big long list of things that end in dev and aren't libraries. And if it isn't called dash dev, it probably isn't a library, except for a big long list of things that don't end in dev and are libraries. It's pretty low tech, but it does actually do a reasonable job of cross-building things. At that time, obviously, there was no package tool chain. There was a magic tool chain that came out, a very clever man in ARM. But in order to jam it into a Debian system, there was a great deal of jiggery-pokery required. And for the packaging system to believe that you had a tool chain, you have to have some equivs packages. If you don't know about equivs, it's incredibly useful. It's a thing that lets you just say, yes, I have this dependency, even though you didn't. And so if you've actually put something in by hook or by crook, it's a good way of saying so. And we just worked out what the build order would be by hand and hacked everything about that. So that took a while and was done a couple of years ago, which is great. You go, okay, so we have an ARM64 port. So what exactly are you doing, Wookie? Well, so I asked how rude I was allowed to be for this talk, and I was told as long as I point out that ARM is an IP company, I can be as rude as I like, which is great. So, because it's an IP company, fundamentally this place is run by lawyers. Right? It feels like a tech company, it's not true. It's the lawyers that get to say no. Or more accurately, don't get to say yes. So until somebody actually says yes, you can't do anything. You certainly can't ship software out of the building. That would be terribly dangerous. So the problem is that FLOSS licenses tend to say something like, if you modify this package and redistribute it, you have to grant a patent license to anyone who wants to do anything with it ever, no matter what. And they go, but that means they could take this bit of software we've modified, change it to do something totally different that covers our patented areas, and they'd still have a license. And you go, well, kind of, but it's difficult to make util Linux or cat or something into an ARM emulator. But, you know, so that's the sort of thing they worry about. And it's much easier for them to just say, no, piss off, than it was to actually review all our patches and decide that it was probably all right, really. So the people who did the work were a bit miffed because they don't get to be famous in the outside world. And we didn't get to upstream all the work we'd done making this work. And I get to do it again, wearing my Linaro hat, which suddenly means I'm not subject to all those tiresome lawyers. I don't think there are any lawyers in Linaro. It's astonishing. There's like 250 people. So as far as I know, we've managed to avoid lawyers, which is great. Probably explains why we get things done. So this is the sort of dangerous stuff that wasn't allowed out of the building. That's like, if cross-building, set the cross-building flags. That's lethal. Mustn't be allowed. So on the one hand, ARM used all our stuff and Ubuntu stuff, the free software tools, did it in the external distro, just like you're supposed to. They just then didn't ship any of that code, rather spoiling the effect. And actually, this goes on a lot in Linaro. There's large corporate entities who want to do things in secret first, and then there's free software people who actually have to do the work. And we end up fighting over exactly what's going out when. People like their early access because, well, they are paying a couple of million quid a year for the privilege of joining and getting all this free software written to give away. So there is a bit of tension there. So I get to do it again. So the amusing thing about most of those patches is that they were written on the outside in Linaro first, but then they kind of got sucked into ARM, and then it was too hard to work out which ones had already come in past the boundary and were therefore probably okay, and which ones had been generated inside and therefore might not be okay. So I did the port starting with Quantel, then Raring. I tried to do Ubuntu and Debian in lockstep, but basically ran out of time. And mostly because Wheezy was in freeze, it was impossible to stream loads of Debian stuff. It was much easier to do the Ubuntu stuff. It's also generally, as Lars observed, this is the classic example of something which is much easier to do in Ubuntu than it is in Debian, because I haven't got to persuade 300 package maintainers that they should take my weird patches about profiles and multi-arch and cross-building and all this other stuff they don't understand and have never heard of and can't see why I should adulterate their packages with this nonsense. Whereas in Canonical, if somebody vaguely important like Colin decides it's worth doing, he can just change all the packages and it's done. So it is a lot easier to do this stuff in an environment where people don't have strong ownership of packages. It's not even that people are unhelpful, it's mostly just that you've got to explain to each person what this is and why they should care and do what you said. And especially when you start doing this, it's all wish list stuff, you know. You can't really say, this is really important, you should put it in now. So things like multi-arch foreign patches, a one-line patch adding multi-arch colon foreign. And you know, a lot of those patches sat around for a year. I discovered last in the US a few weeks ago that autoconf guy had just uploaded it because somebody had kicked him about it. And he said, well, I didn't know what it was. Someone wanted to add this line. For all I knew, it did something really bad. So it turns out not everybody is watching what we're doing, and you do have to go and explain. So that was all done in public. The problem was that I was doing four things at once, adding multi-arch, making things cross-build, adding the profile stuff, and adding a new architecture, which is a great way of proceeding relatively slowly. And because the tools don't support it yet, you have to have your own modified versions of sbuild and apt and dpackage. None of this is very hard. You just have to patch things and stick them in a repo, except that people keep changing the upstream versions. You have to keep repatching things. And yeah, it's annoying carrying deltas around, as we all know. But yes, it worked very nicely. One other thing is there's no QEMU for ARM64, so you can't rely on random foreign binaries that packages use during their build on working. They will just explode. So I have tried quite hard to design the cross stuff so that you don't assume you've got QEMU, because for an early architecture, you probably haven't got one. Later on, it's a really handy thing to have around because it glosses over a lot of broken details. So the process, prepare a repository to put stuff into, add your new architecture. That's one thing that's totally trivial in Debian. You add one line to the OZ table in dpackage and you're done. Everything consults that, so that works nicely. Set up a machine to build in. Make a tool chain. That bit's a pain. Fix stuff and start building. So how much work is needed to do a bootstrap? So I just updated these last night. The base system the bootstrap does is 116 packages, binary packages, and about 12 more when you add build essential, which is 65 source packages. But fortunately, a lot of those have dependencies, so you actually need to build about 120 source packages to get a totally minimal debootstrappable image, and that's actually 500 binaries. I was surprised how big that number was. I think we keep splitting them up smaller and smaller. For comparison, Ubuntu is a bit bigger, mostly because you've got Plymouth. It's really hard to get rid of Plymouth, and Plymouth means Cairo and GTK and, oh Jesus, I don't know, a whole load of crap. You didn't want X. So that's like an extra 20 packages just so that you can boot with a shiny boot screen that probably doesn't even work because you haven't got graphics yet. But I said, can't we take it out? And they went, no, it's way too hard. Just build all the software, honestly. I don't know anything about Ubuntu. So, a few more mildly interesting details. So you set up your chroot. This is trivial. You just run sbuild create chroot. So the nice thing about this is it's a bog-standard chroot. You didn't do anything special to it, basically, for your normal build architecture. And within that, you can cross-build for anything. Now, the only wrinkle for ARM64 is that there's no libssp, so you have to turn off the -f stack protector. But it's okay. We have depackaged build flags, which is pretty much respected everywhere, at least in the base system. So you just set that magic variable in your chroot, and everything doesn't build with that thing it hasn't got. Works very nicely. And then you set a crazy priority for your hacked up packages with special dependencies so that it'll keep using them. And that works very nicely. So the reason we haven't got libssp, it turns out, is that the ARM64 stack grows the opposite way to nearly everybody else's stacks, and libssp relies on you running off the end and hitting a magic canary. But if it's the other way around, it doesn't run off the end, it runs backwards and destroys the rest of the stack. And you go, oh. So the GCC people have gone, ah, damn, we didn't think of that. Turns out Alpha doesn't have libssp either for the same reason. Sorry? PA risk, all right. So they're going to fix that. I'm not quite sure how. Stuff. So, yeah, just to illustrate that the cross stuff is easy, I'll actually talk about this a bit later, so not too much detail, but once you've installed your cross-build essential stuff, you can just do get build deps for this architecture for this package, and then build it for this architecture. So it really is, using the standard tools, it's very simple. This is lovely. This is how it's supposed to work. And increasingly, that's how it does work. You do also, for many packages, have to set a config site variable, if it's autoconf, so that it finds the magic, how long is a float on this architecture, which otherwise has no way of knowing. And in general, you don't want to run the checks, because they'll be for the wrong architecture, and the machine will fall over as soon as you get there. There are packages that have architecture-independent checks, so we didn't force this in the system. It's something you get to set. And we probably want a tiny little wrapper that will do that for you by default, just to save you having to type environment variables. So we modified sbuild to understand this host equals blah and just pass it through the system to apt. And the same with the profiles. It's all really rather slick. So you can just pass the profile option in on my modified tools. And as soon as Guillaume agrees what syntax it takes, we'll have that in the distro. So you just use sbuild the same as you did before, but with a profile and with an architecture. It's nice. I set up this craziness, which is just how it was done. You pull the sources you care about, the bottom, whatever it was, 120 packages, 140 packages, into a thingy, then ask rep repro which ones have sources but no binaries yet, which makes a list. You then, at this point, manually look at your list and decide what order to do it in. I then have this really crappy shell script, what I wrote, which just manages getting the dependencies and sort of running this build in the right place, seeing if it worked and uploading them if it did, and run around that until you've got them all. Easy peasy. So a guy called Johannes Schauer was my GSOC student 2 years ago, and he's a genius. It's really good if you can get students who are geniuses. It's great. So he updated a thing. So if you come across EDOS DebCheck, which does the Debian weather, if you've ever noticed that web page, it tells you whether things are currently installable or not. It's basically a general-purpose dependency analysis tool that the Mancusi project in France did. That's all written in a camel, which is the unfortunate part. But if you can find someone who understands that stuff, it's very easy to write fast analysis of large dependency sets. So you can actually ask it, is this package buildable or cross-buildable with profiles, blah, 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 in the archive that I have, in this archive, using those things and that stuff now, and it'll say yes or no. Or it'll give you a great big list saying, build them in this order. Or, it's impossible, there is no order, which is what it usually says. So those tools are very useful, and we should probably use them more widely for all sorts of other places, like WannaBuild, which sort of uses the old EDOS DebCheck, but not the new DOES 3, which is an updated version. So this stuff has developed a bit recently. So about a week ago, bootstrap.debian.net appeared, which is running this tool, Botch, every day, to tell you whether the archive is currently bootstrappable. Now, its definition is currently extremely generous. It says, if you could build the base system and deb helper, and you knew where to break things, it would be possible to bootstrap the distribution. Now, at the moment, neither of those things are actually true for any architecture, so none of them are. But it illustrates that it's not fundamentally impossible, you just need to do some more work. I think I have a link, because trying to explain this is way too difficult. So it runs the tool and gives you this thing, which alleges that stuff works. And here's a couple I downloaded earlier. So it just tells you all about all these sets of loops. So there's a main connected set in Debian, which used to be about 30 packages, is now about 1,000. There we are, 1,352 vertices. I'm not sure if that amounts to packages or just connections between packages, but anyway, there's a big knot in the core, which is the tricky part. Most of the rest of it does flow out in a more or less tree-shaped thing. And this also uses some heuristics from Gentoo, which knows the things you can usually disable. So some things are obvious, like LDAP, basically. You can always turn off. It's always optional. And that's involved in a whole load of this annoying, knotty stuff. LDAP and Kerberos and Cyrus Sazzel and a whole load of bollocks that I didn't really want to have to build just to get a base distro. At the moment, you do. So that's a useful tool, and it will be connected to the PTS, and as soon as this profile stuff is in, normal package maintainers can look and see if their package is part of the problem or not. This will be a good thing. For this year's GSOC, I had another student who came back after a couple of years before. It's fair to say he knew much more stuff this year than he did the first time he turned up. It's nice to see people learning stuff. And he improved my horrible dimstrap script to something that you could actually use. Now, for various reasons, I haven't actually used it just now, but it is quite neat, and I think will be useful. So it turns out that for the base system, you actually only need to add profiles to 10 or 12 packages. It's not a huge thing. We reckon to do the entire distro, all that analysis suggests there's 80 packages you have to touch. So this isn't a huge thing to maintain, which is good. And the point of doing all that analysis. There's a whole load of usual suspects like Swig. So, you know, it's the Python and the TCL and the Java bindings for your stupid little app that make it hard to build. Or your core tool, sorry. And the LDAP and stuff like that. Turn those things off. Easy to build it the first time, blah, blah, blah. A bit later you'll get to that package, rebuild it again in normal mode. So, because Wheezy was in freeze and I ran out of time and then Ari wanted me to do something else and stop fiddling with all this nonsense, nobody cares about Debian for God's sake, I didn't get the Debian bootstrap done back in February this year when the Ubuntu one was finished, brought up to a base system. So in the meantime, Canonical have done some work and they were using Secret Source, which they couldn't tell us about at DebConf. Docker let the name slip at the last connect, but he was shushed rapidly by that man over there, so I probably shouldn't tell you. But anyway, they had some stuff which was faster than models for building things, and about 2 weeks before Saucy was released, they got real hardware that actually worked properly and managed to build 30,000 packages in a couple of weeks, 30,000 binaries. So basically, Ubuntu, Saucy, and Trusty now have a full ARM64 distro for your purposes. So the things that aren't ported are the things that aren't ported upstream. So the Mono people haven't done it yet, the Haskell people, Ruby, I don't know, languages, basically, that actually involve non-trivial amounts of work to port to a new architecture. OCaml was done last week. I saw a mail go by. So because of that, I decided to use the Ubuntu cheroot for the Debian bootstrap because for this purpose, they're nearly the same, and it is a lot easier to just natively build with all the dependencies available and not worry about cross-building and bootstrapping and multi-arch and all the patches that haven't quite made it into Debian yet because some lazy maintainer hasn't uploaded them or I forgot to send it in a year ago or whatever. And in fact, the only catch is that nobody would give me any hardware. We tried some blagging, but we failed miserably. It's still very thin on the ground. And unfortunately, there's lots of iPhones, but nobody knows how to hack those to make them do anything useful. So that's no good. And the other hardware, which does run Linux, is not available to itinerant distributions with no money. if you're not Facebook, you can't have one. So at the moment, I haven't got any hardware. ARM have produced this foundation model, which is free beer, which has been very useful. But it is very slow because it's a full machine emulation of absolutely everything, including the networking and the disk access and so on. However, the SUSE people did a port of QEMU. They did it a while ago. They definitely didn't do that because that would be illegal and impossible. I didn't say that. About two days after the ARM specification, which is the list of how this architecture works, appeared, so did a QEMU port. So they wrote it really fast. So that's great. And I built that a couple of weeks ago. See, lawyers think that's fine. It doesn't matter at all. It's perfect. Of course we rest in 2 days. Nothing has been contravened at all. It's a very odd world. But if anybody had written anything before they saw the documentation, that would have been terrible. So QEMU is about 20 times faster than the model. It's like a sort of sluggish computer. It's perfectly good. So in 2 weeks since Connect, I've built all the packages, all 120 packages of the base distro. Now, it's been quite labor-intensive, and I haven't seen very much of my wife this last 2 weeks, but, it does work at a reasonable speed. So all you do is nobble the dpackage origin files and the LSB release info in the Ubuntu cheroot to lie and say, I'm Debian, definitely. Install Debian sources and just build stuff. I was doing it on this nice box that a nice man at Huawei lent me, which has lots of Welly. Each individual core isn't that fast, but there's lots of them. It turns out, actually, there's much less parallelization in this process than you'd like. So it's been very hard to keep most of those busy, actually. Mostly I've been using one of them. But I got it up to about 65 a couple of times. And because I don't have root on this box, you have to have a clean root, and then for every build, you run a Debianized script, which you just add another dpackage-i to the bottom of. It keeps installing more hacked packages until it gets increasingly Debian-y every time you run it. And I was expecting a whole load of aggravation for this process and all sorts of things to go wrong, but actually it was very painless. Pretty much everything works as expected. In fact, I'll get on to the things that broke in a moment. So this is the SUSE QEMU port, so it's available. There's binaries online on that handy web page if anybody wants to play with ARM64. It's working its way into upstream now. They did say spring, they're now saying summer, so it'll be a while before it's in standard, but we can stick it in the Debian one forthwith, really. I had no idea how QEMU worked before last week, but it turns out it's fairly simple. You build this magic binary to jam into the rootfs, and then in the external machine, the actual kernel that's running, no matter how many chroots out that is, you have to have this magic so that those bytes at the beginning of the file masked by this mask are that, in which case it gives it to that thing. It's very handy. And it mostly works. So it's only user space, which has some limitations. So you do occasionally hit an undefined instruction. So, for example, building the bash man pages with ghost script. Apparently that emits an instruction hardly used anywhere else and explodes. But that's not fatal to the build, so that was okay. Java doesn't work at all. Even attempting to install Java makes it explode. Apparently Java does really hard threading things, and QEMU doesn't cope very well with threading things. So it's basically impossible to run Java on QEMU. There's still cyclic dependency issues. I had to do some of this stage bootstrapping stuff. And this was the most interesting part. So two days ago, the last thing I had to build was GCC. You build GCC and it doesn't run. And we did some peering at the entrails to discover that CC1 has a different magic to every other binary you've built in the entire bootstrap. It's got two bits different in that little magic string, which is why, if you look at all the architectures people actually use, there's a little mask byte there, because that couple of bits in that byte may or may not change, depending on, I don't know, something. The readelf said it was Unix GNU, not Unix System V, unlike everything else. I have no idea where that comes from. So that's pretty strange. But once you've told QEMU that you didn't care about those two bits, and can you please just run it, same as all the others, it works fine. The other thing that was a bit painful was that in unstable we're on 5.18, so Saucy was still 5.16, so everything Purley that was architecture independent had to be rebuilt, otherwise you can't install tech.
Wookie, if you want to know about the ELF stuff, ask me later. I can tell you more than you ever wanted to know.
I did think you... will be kind of interesting, some value of interesting.
When we were doing the ARMHF bring up and we were fighting against bits and pieces of that, it's scary and really not well understood.
No, none of us knew anything about it. The other thing, for some reason, it got to the end of this and some things weren't quite right. It turned out that if you asked my machine that I definitely told it was Debian, it was still claiming to be Ubuntu, because apparently we put our LSB release files in different places, so I'd failed to clear out the extra one when I reinstalled base files over the top. And that one, the Ubuntu one, takes precedence if it's present, even if you've got the Debian version installed. Gosh, stupid thing. Obviously, the Arch all stuff is easy. Built those packages, and 6 p.m. yesterday, ta-da, it works. So there is now. And that's why all my slides are crap, especially the next one later, because it was much more interesting to build just one more ARM64 package for the last 3 days than it was to write these slides. So yeah, that's cool. So that is just Bootstrap plus Build Essential and Deb Helper. You can't do very much exciting, but I did build a package and it seemed to build, so I guess we'll call that working. Now I just need someone to give me some hardware and we can build the other 25,000. Actually, because all those were built on an Ubuntu cheroot, we don't know that they're right. There's probably various slightly obscure breakages and incorrections. So actually, I'll rebuild all that stuff again. Possibly not until some faster stuff turns up. And then we'll be sure. And that's what's going to go into ports. And yes, and then we'll have a port. So if anyone wants to play, those wiki pages are where everything is documented. So that's the repository that stuff is going into, and that's where it tells you what runes to type. The QEMU stuff's documented, and I think that's it. Even on time. The things like any questions, anything I forgot to tell you?
I think you've shocked them all.
Wow. People have mostly stayed awake, which is always a good sign. Leif has a question.
So I think I said this to you in private or on IRC or something. Do we need to reconsider for when we're bringing up an architecture that is evidently going to end up in the archive? It's not a it is not another SH4. We're not never going to actually do anything with it. Do we need to consider doing an initial import using emulation to make it easier once we get the hardware to rebootstrap it in the main archive? Mm-hmm. As in, we start with in the archive with it signed with one key like we did for ARMHF. We know we're not going to release those binaries, but we keep them in unstable. We then bootstrap it again with another build D signing key so that we can keep track of those binaries. We then reinstall the hardware again and rebuild it again. But we've already got a base to work from.
Do we need
to consider this?
I see no reason why we shouldn't do that. So certainly you could say we don't care about putting that stuff in ports.
Absolutely. Why go into ports, rebuild everything,
right,
take the relevant bits out of ports, put them into the main archive, rebuild everything? It just feels like we're making work for ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, if we had a flag somewhere that said this just can't migrate to testing yet.
Yeah, that's called Adam not adding it to the Brittany configuration file. Mm. But, yeah.
That sounds like a really cool idea. What we've done for the last few architectures that have been bootstrapped in ports, I think the reason why that's happened is because they've been largely done by non-DDs as well.
So, yeah, what do we have to do to make that happen?
Do it.
Right, okay. Well, that sounds like a good plan.
All in favour?
We're probably supposed to check all against. Just, I wouldn't want to be accused of unfairness. Right.
Okay,
thank you. Yes.
Yay. Any other questions?
Probably time for coffee by now, surely. Oh, no? Question.
So, when can I do bootstrap?
Sorry, what?
When can I debootstrap?
Now. Well, there is a working debootstrap as of yesterday. If you don't care if your packages might potentially be a tiny bit Ubuntu-y. And that appears to work. It's not very well tested yet, but it booted and installed more stuff and built things, so it basically works for our purposes. I mean, if you want to do real stuff, you probably want to use Ubuntu because you get 30,000 packages, not 120. But that cheroot I've uploaded last night, so you can just start with that and progress.
To avoid me being shot, I've just thought we do need to talk to Build D and DSA about how we'd handle the Build D situation before we do any of that, because presumably we'd need i386 or AMD64 hardware to run the software emulation for the Build Ds effectively.
Yes.
Yes, and so the problem just to avoid DSA trying to hang me when I get back to York, I'd just like to say we do need to talk to them first.
We do. And also, we can't actually use QEMU, even though it's relatively quick, because it just explodes on all the tests and doesn't do all sorts of things. So, but we can run models, which will just sit there very slowly building things, and I think that's perfectly good.
If very slow.
Yeah. Once it's automated, we don't really care. At least it'll get some things built until we get something better. There are mutterings, so I hassled Beedale last week, saying, come on, there must be someone at HP we can bend. I know, but he knows the people. So I am hopeful that we will get some hardware in a reasonable period of time, but nobody's saying when yet.
Based on what you were saying, the QEMU run this foreign binary thing is working.
Mm.
Is the QEMU system emulation working to the point that
no QEMU system emulation for ARM64.
So no one's just put a versatile together with it or something?
No. So and that will get written by these QEMU people at some point, but not until they've integrated this stuff, which will be in the next couple of months. So maybe by summer there'll be a full emulation, unless somebody gets their finger out and does it faster. The current schedule is yes, but not for a while. We're not the only people who'd really, really like one. So there's a fair amount of pressure, but I think it'll still be a while. It's a non-trivial piece of work. There are two people at Linaro that work on QEMU. That's covering all the ARM flavors. And I guess there's some SUSE people who are experts, but I don't know to what degree they're still working on that. Okay.
Any more?
Nope, we've all had enough. Right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rocky.